PhD fellowships.
15 PhD?
Yeah, 15 for students.
In geography or like in?
Of course, coming from ASU, and you just got your degree last year, the year before.
August 17th. Yeah.
So, year and a half ago. And I'm sure that you saw the announcement, so his bio is quite impressive there. Awards of best research paper from AAG, and research initiatives in sponsored research from NSF, NIH, NASA, and so on. But I'm not going to read all that.
No.
I'll let you start with your formal presentation. Thanks for allowing us to record it. And afterwards, we'll just have a open floor discussion.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mandy, for the introduction. And yeah, again, I'm Jing Chen. I'm now a postdoc at Arizona State. And today, I have to talk about one of the projects I have been working on for about, I think, like 3 years, and across my PhD to my postdoc. And this project just, we submit our final report to NSF December 2018, and that's NSF CNH project, a couple of human and natural environment systems. And the topic today is about invasive species. And I make an interesting first sentence. They thrive as cancer cells in forests. And this morning I did this in the medical school. And actually there's a big connection between invasive species and the cancer cells. But today I will talk about how the spatial, social, and the ecological factors really driving the distribution of Meccanian in Nepal area. And that's in the Chitwan National Park. So, see this one. That's the work. Okay. So, going to some background knowledge. So, I mean, we all talk about urbanization a lot, and United Nations mentioned by 2050 we'll get about 70-75% of the urban areas in the world, and most of the population will live in urban areas. However, we still have a lot of rural populations, and they will actually live next to the forest and get resources from forest. And forest still serve as a natural biodiversity hotspot for a lot of endangered species, everything. However, more and more people, like when they trying to make livelihood based on forest, and they go into the forest and collect their resources and doing agriculture and doing harvesting. And it really caused the problem of the degradation. And certainly, the forest degradation really caused problems, loss of biodiversity, and crisis for endangered species and animals. And also, it reduces resource availability, and people need to go to somewhere else. And these things just keep getting worse and worse. I would say something about a concept of the community forest. And this forest, the community forest mostly exists in the South Asian and the South American. And that is a way for the local resource users to manage the forest rather than for the government. So sometimes in those countries, the developing countries, the government will not have the capability to maintain the forest. So eventually the local people, they really doing a bottom-up management. So they trying to maintain a forest by themselves. They organize a committee and really doing, like, they can do a very good at resource provisioning. So basically they know what they want and they kind of plan across the time. And also with the community forest, they know where to get the resources. They will not disturb too much to like protected areas, such as national parks sometimes. But there's a problem, like when you have a community forest, especially in developing country context, it will have some inequality in decision making. So somebody like in the like gender is really strong problem, like sometimes in male, they will have a stronger decision to do a lot of things. So it has good side and it has bad side. This research, we're really focusing on the Western Chittagong Valley. And so this is the urban areas in the middle. And in case you don't know, where's Nepal? It's right between India and China. And our study area is in the kind of central side of Nepal. And Kathmandu, I think, is right here. And so basically, that's the urban area. And that's the Chittagong National Park. And in the park, there's like several different endangered species of tigers and rhinos. And that's a famous tourism area, actually, in Nepal. But when the people try to get their livelihood, I mean, they want to get resources from forest, they are kind of prohibited to go into the national park to get like a firewood folder. But they will be okay to doing things in the forest, community forest areas. But one of the problems really happened there for kind of a long time, about 20 years, is the invasive species in forest. And generally speaking, I mean, Dr. Wilson mentioned about how dangerous invasive species in forest. And you can see here, that's kind of real pictures our team took in Nepal. And this is kind of the mechanism, the vines kind of climbing up to the trees, and eventually you kind of cover the treetop and get all the nutrition and light, everything. So yeah, and it has a different than mile a minute. So it's like we'll probably grow a mile in a minute. So it's a really dangerous species. And I think it ranks as top three most dangerous species, invasive species in the world. And this one is actually originally from American. And just brought into the South Asia and caused problems, not only in Nepal, but also in China. A lot of Chinese scholars, they really are just trying to understand how to prevent that in Guangdong province and Guangxi province. And there's a lot of research there, and also in India, in that area. So for invasive species, certainly you will see this Albuel's environmental influence to the ecosystem. It reduces the biodiversity, it kills the native species, and it makes the forest not longer good for animals and all other type of species. It really changed the ecosystem. But also think of the community forest will also be used for the local people. And it will really kind of influence the local livelihood as well as reduce the resource availability. They will not be able to collect firewood folder, those kind of stuff, or send them additional plants for use for their daily life. Because of invasive species kills everything, they need to find somewhere else to get those resources. So zooming a little bit more to look at the real Chittagong area, we kind of categorize the forest to three different types. That's a south forest, and kind of majority of the tree type is called the south is kind of an acronym. And the Bombax is another type of forest, and the Dalbergia is the other one. And those two are kind of right next to the rivers. And you can see this one is the map of the Meccanian coverage from our ecological survey. And we got a majority of Meccanian in the Bombax forest and the Dalbergia forest. And south forest is predominant by another type of invasive species called Chromalina. And today I will not talk too much here, but we were really focusing on the Kenyan Bombax forest. So, the research question really in this project and in this presentation is we really try to understand what is the current Kenyan patterns in Chittagong Nepal. And to be more specific, are the current distribution of Meccanian correlated with human disturbance, human activities, ecological factors, say things related to biophysical factors, and also the spatial elements. And Meccanian, as you can see here, that's a dominant invasive species plant. To understand this question, we really need to, from an ecological side of thoughts, we kind of need to understand, kind of come up with some hypothesis why this happened and what will be the potential factors. And we separate it out to from local to regional scales, as well as from biophysical side to social side. And what will really influence the percent coverage of the Meccanian? So disturbance, certainly that's kind of the main factor to change the forest landscape. Something like a flooding, you saw the rivers, right? So something like a flooding, and it will change the river bank significantly. And also like a tree fall, and you will really change your landscape. And besides that, some of the environmental factors, including the canopy coverage and the historical greenness, the vegetation greenness, will also influence that. But going a bit up about to a bit more social side, and from a local scale, we have that plot level observations of the human activities, so how people are really doing things in every spot, and also from regional side, what's the local trails into the forest, and will that really create more disturbance? So it goes to really up to the more of a human related stuff, and people really are doing the invasive plant removal from like household level and the community forest level. And household level, they will go into the forest and do their resource collection and trying to get a firewood, they get a starch at a certain season. And also they're trying to, when they're trying to collect those resources, they were kind of doing the invasive species removal at the same time because it covers everything. So you have to remove the Meccanian first and then get a firewood starch. And also, because these old community forests are managed by the local people and they know that's a big problem, so they trying to do the jungle cleaning, we call it, and that's basically they organize the household in using this community forest. They kind of have a good control, like this group of household will just get resources from this forest, this group will go for this forest. So they will organize them to go into the forest and collect, I mean, trying to do the forest cleaning and remove the invasive species to help the overall system more sustainable. So here I talk about the potential factors contribute to the Meccanian cover in the forest. And next thing is that how will we be able to collect those data? And it really goes to a lot of efforts. We really, our team, the ecological team, and the social survey team, social demographers, they go into the treatment area, and they really doing the ecological survey and a social survey, and for both the household users as well as the community forest managers. For the ecological survey, we basically create a parallel transect every 200 meters. You see that? That's a forest. And we create a transect every 200 meters. And we're doing a survey along this transect. And every time we create, that's a 5x10, but it's actually 5 meter by 5 meter on the left. Oh, and maybe say on the west and 5x5 on the east. And that's 5x5, 5x5. And they look at the ecological characteristics in that plot. And after that, they collect all the information, and they move 50 meters away, going along this transect, and they will do it again, and we collect a series of ecological plots along the transect. So besides that, we do a human activity analysis, and we use an innovative tablet social survey methods. So we design an app on, a Windows tablet. And you have a map, you can zoom in, zoom out, and you have the options on the side, and you can say firewood, and you zoom into the area. See if that works? Yeah, it works. You zoom into the area, and then say, okay, we collect the firewood in this area last year. We collect a folder in this area last year. So we asked 1,200 households to do this survey. at both 2014 and 2017 for two runs. So after we collect all the spatial polygon data set, I mean, this is a huge data cleaning process. But after that, we got complete information in one of the community forests with a lot of, that's kind of human perception of where they collect resources in last year. And we overlap it with our ecological plots. And say if there's a surge overlapping that plot for 7 times, we'll give an intensity of 7. So basically represent the resource collection intensity from the social survey. So here's like a complete map generating from 2014 and 1,235 households. And we got 6 different categories for different households, including grazing, medicinal plants, picnic, relax, starch, fodder, and firewood. And another interesting research question related to it, so a lot of people drawing the circles outside of a community forest into the national park, and that's prohibited. And that's another research ongoing. It's called illegal collection, and that's the social demographers in our team is working on that right now. Further, we ask the community forest managers. There's 21 community forests and there's 21 managers, and ask them where did you see that area for the formal flooding last year? What's the grass and the tree plantation? What's the jungle cleaning happened last year? And they come out with their kind of expert knowledge, we can say that. That's kind of an expert knowledge for how the forest get maintained. As a geographer in the team, we also generate several other variables from the remote sensing in the GIS. So including we got Landsat 5, 7, and 8 to generate the EVI, the Enhanced Vegetation Index, to represent the historical vegetation greenness. And especially we pick 3 cutoff point time, like 88 to 89, that's before Mikania invade the forest. 2000 and 2001, that's kind of the time when Mikania first discovered in that area, and then goes to 2013 to 2014, and that's basically Mikania kind of get spread out in abundance everywhere. And we also calculate, we delineate the river boundaries from image and calculate the distance to river.
Ask a quick basic question. So is it true that this invasive species requires full sun? So it's only going to grow in a disturbed place? Or is that a complex answer?
That's a complex answer.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So, and further, we got a road data set and just those local trails and trying to understand the distance between the ecological plots to the the trails and the roads. And also we got the elevation slope based on the ASTER digital elevation model. So after all of this data collection, and we got a huge spreadsheet with about 400 different variables, 400 columns, and the total ecological plots, we got about, 2,219 plots. So next steps, we're trying to understand in this complex social ecological system, what are the real natural anthropogenic, human factors that will contribute to invasive species, both occurrence and abundance? Statistical methods, but we use both the Mikanian abundance and occurrence data. And occurrence is, you think of 0 and 1. We collect in a percentage, but we can kind of easily convert from 0 and 1. And abundance will remove all the zeros and only focusing on there's a Mikanian and what really drive the abundance for that. And the factors contribute to it. And we got the social data, human related data. We got ecological data, biophysical data, and also historical and current land use data. So we have to, because we have so many parameters, and we have to, we will not be able to include everything at the same time, and also it will come up with a lot of collinear problem. So we kind of use the expert knowledge to, especially from the ecology side, they have kind of a theory why invasive species will thrive in the forest. So we kind of use their expert knowledge to really select the predictors and remove the collinear variables and also remove the low sample size. And because in this case, the zero inflated, the reason use the negative binomial is that the Meccanian, we still have a lot of zeros for a lot of plots. So we eventually find out the negative binomial would be probably the best way to fit the distribution in our case. Go through the predictor variables. We have four different sets basically, and the household level, I just show you the six different categories. And for the community forest management level, we got jungle cleaning, fire, plantation. Yeah, so that's also shown in the previous slides. Ecological survey, peak the canopy cover. That's kind of a way to represent the light environment. And other invasive species, because sometimes, I mean, most of the times invasive species co-occur. There's a co-occurrence for invasive species. And native species, fire evidence, flooding, carting, and falling trees, and also the data from the geospatial data set, elevation, distance, river, road, and EVI. So to do the model, we use kind of, sometimes there's different ways in the interdisciplinary research, we use different ways to build a model. And especially there's a huge difference between the sociology, ecology, anthropology, and the geography. And we have all of the people from different disciplines. And we eventually decide to do this just to first model how the social factors, if there's a relationship between the social factors and the Meccanian, and adding the community forest again, and adding the ecological variable again. The reason behind that is kind of, we kind of know the ecological parameters will be the dominant factors still to influence the invasive species. And but we still want to test if those social variables, human perceptions, will really influence that. And the first model, we just find out two significance. The firewood have a positive relationship with the Meccanian occurrence, and this is occurrence model, just 0 and 1. Make sure you understand. Yeah, and for the pygmy relax, we have a negative relationship. And yeah, it's kind of experience when people are trying to do the collections, they will tend to bring a seed everywhere, and it will just cause Meccanian spread out. And for a picnic relax, for sure, like people typically, they will not try to doing a picnic in like a Meccanian invasive species spot, and they will probably pick a better place. Further, we're adding the community forest survey data into the model, and we found out kind of that's kind of marginal. That's almost 0.1. But as fire is really increased the occurrence of Meccanian. And also remember this survey we asked them last year with a fire. So when we match that with the ecological data set, we'll find out, okay, so if when there's a fire and the whole system get disturbed, I mean, there's a disturbance to that, and it will just make invasive species invade much easier because there's nothing. And then after that, we're adding the ecological, say, biophysical variables. Three things we kind of find out. So the Adjuranta is one of the other invasive species in the area. It kind of co-occur with Meccanian, and that's kind of match with our hypothesis. And then native species just get here. I mean, that makes sense because invasive species squeeze all the native species. It's hard for them to still be there with Meccanian. And the flood has a negative relationship. And the reason behind that is like, anywhere after flood, and it will not be suitable for Meconium to grow in a short period of time, basically. So if that's an inundated area, it will not be able to, it is not a good place for Meconium anymore. So after the occurrence model, we just run the same thing for the abundance model. Similar things, I mean, we find out some differences first. So the Argyrenta, so that's positive relationship in the occurrence model, but that's negative relationship in the abundance model. And the reason kind of behind that is because these two invasive species, if one is getting really abundance at one plot, even the other one is really hard to compete with. And kind of canopy cover kind of relates to the light environment. So if you have really dense canopy cover, and the Meconium is kind of wide on the ground, it's kind of hard to get enough light to get abundance in the area. And so some of the disturbance field survey really showing a positive relationship, including the cutting and the fire evidence. And it really shows that human disturbance will really influence that. So that's the negative binomial, zero inflated negative binomial models. But from as a like geographer, and I further use some of the spatial statistics methods. And I think most of you probably know the geographic weighted regression. And for the general statistics, we don't really think every data point will contribute to the specific points. But this is not very true every time, because in a kind of landscape ecology field, and we really think the nearest things will contribute more to the specific data points. And geographically, GWR basically kind of borrowing data from nearby locations. And we can define the bandwidth in multiple different ways. But the general idea is we will not use all of the data to do this. And the a big difference is here, what I have done is that's called a semi-parametric GWR models. So in the original GWR, we treat every variables as local variables. That means everything is kind of locally, you will find a bandwidth to try to kind of borrowing from nearby, say 500 data points. But actually sometimes we will have some globally fixed terms that's kind of similar to original statistics. All the data points contribute to it. But some of the terms will be locally varying terms. So this will allow some parameters to vary across space, and some of them just be fixed. So by running this semi-parametric GWR model to the specific to this research, and yeah, we find out something kind of quite interesting. So if you remember, so the canopy coverage is kind of so specifically goes into different forest types. And we will have different estimates from like, so here's a 0.1 to 0.39. And we'll have really a different landscape of how canopy cover really influence the Meconium abundance here. And that's just one example, and I mean we can map out every parameters that is significant here, and also you will see some of the points are actually missing, and that's because that is not statistically significant, so I just remove it. And another kind of interesting is the local R square. So when run the semi-parametric, you'll be able to get a local R square, and the things like you will see like the local R square can range from really low like that to almost like zero, or say like 0.13 or 0.26, but can go really up to 0.52. So that means there's a really a spatial variability in every forest, even at the different ecological plots. So there's kind of more interesting stories underneath, and the thing is that to explain this pattern is kind of difficult, because we really need some like local knowledge. So how the forest happen, what kind of things happen in the forest? We kind of need to talk with the ecologist and see what's the real reason like causing this different situations across the forest. So yeah, but it goes to kind of conclusion here. So what are the drivers of the species invasion for New Canyon? And yeah, so our findings, I mean, that's consistent with the literature say the invasive species still predominantly associated with the ecological and the biophysical drivers. And also like the ground-based disturbance kind of more effective predictors than people's perception. And also like social factors really influence some level of the invasive species. And but the findings that that's not that, I mean, that's significant, but that's not that strong. So we have some influence from the social side and but predominant from the ecological side. After this analysis, and what we want to really do is to doing some intervention. The important thing is just to see after intervention, can we just stop the invasive species keep growing in the forest? And we have four different treatment types in five community forests. We pick five different types of forest. And the traditional method of the forest cleaning is really just treatment to all plants, no matter it is invasive or it is native. And sometimes they're just doing it really rough and just not really completely uprooting. Now on the other side, the modified way is to only to invasive species and completely uprooting and also back and bury. That's kind of avoid the seeds to go everywhere. And also there's actually a debate between using a fire and not using a fire. And that's because using a fire kind of you can just kind of destroy everything, but that will kind of make the ecosystem imbalanced and make the future invasion much easier. And yeah, and as I mentioned, so after this, we have actually done this starting 17 to 2018, and modified with the non-burn no fire is kind of the best way to do that. And the reason behind that is trying to keep the natural environment and trying to keep the native species to kind of go back to predominant in the area, and we don't want the fire to kind of destroy it. Another thing we can do is more on the spatial statistics side. So recently, the Dr. Fotheringham and further developed the semi-parametric GWR to that is called monkey scale GWR. And for the current GWR, we have kind of a way so to decide the bandwidth, basically how many data points you want to borrow. But you use kind of an average bandwidth for every single parameters. And you can see like for X1 parameters, that's same bandwidth for different data points will be different, but that's kind of same for everything. But a more intuitive and more meaningful way is to doing this in a different settings. Things can be different. So for the parameter 1, we have its own bandwidth. Parameter 2, we have kind of narrowed down. 3 and 4. And semi-parametric is actually, we have global parameters and the local parameters. You can think like the global parameters will be the bandwidth will be across all the data points. And for the local parameters, you only have like a fix for every parameters. But right now, the methodology can just release for every parameters, so you have your own bandwidth. And you will kind of create a better representation for the entire landscape. So that can be done. They already finished the software development, and that's in the Spark website. Check it out. And that's kind of useful, and I believe that will give us a better understanding of the GWR, because GWR is kind of one of the most misused methods in spatial statistics, and I believe that will give us some ideas to move this project forward. acknowledgement about our project and funded by NSF through CNH project. And one of our team members get supported by Fulbright, and the ISER in Nepal is our long-term academic partnership to help us to, I mean, a lot of logistic, doing the survey, and that's really helpful. And we got a team from ASU, Penn State, San Diego State, and Michigan. And yeah, so this overall project is finished, but what I have taught, I mean, just present today, one of the negative binomial analysis, the other is the GWR. Both of that is like a mandatory under preparation, and it probably come out like later this year, 2019. I was interviewed today about a postdoc position, relationship to both the HMS, the medical school, and here in CGA. And here are some of the comparison of the invasive species to the human tumors. And I believe that's really connected, and they share a lot of same characteristics. So they invade the new environment when some natural enemy, and they kind of squeeze and kill the native species and cells, and they need actual intervention to solve the problem. So a lot of the geospatial technologies can be used from the invasive species can be used, or say from the geospatial GI science and remote sensing can be used in the human tumor research. And several methods I just listed there, agent-based modeling, spatial statistics, and satellite imagery analysis, and spatial clustering. So one of the kind of the most exciting things here is really this kind of combination is unique. And I believe that will not only benefit the cancer biology, but also benefit the GI science domain. And the good thing is that methods are somewhat similar, and sometimes we just use different terms to define same thing or similar things. So the good thing is that with this joint position, I probably learn a lot of the cancer biology and learn their methodologies and see if there's a methodology can be used in GIS, and see if our methods can be used in cancer biology. And the methodologies can really just share and borrow, and we can really say open a new interdisciplinary domain, or maybe kind of understand the research questions in our area in geography much better. So that's all. And elephants, do you like it? Thank you. Yeah.
I asked a lot of questions morning already, sorry. But how are you treating the interdependencies of your input variables?
Independent variables?
You're in the supposedly independent variable,
right.
But obviously they are dependent to each other. They are related too. So when you say, for example, human activity had seemed like less dominant compared to ecological factors, but then human activities alter the ecological factors too, right? Human activity, their impact, they're not going there and planting the invasive species. They're going there to alter the environmental conditions, so they are dependent to each other,
right?
Even
and
though you're calling them independent variables,
from statistical perspective, they are kind of independent, and from the statistical testing, but yes. So this happens a lot when I talk with social demographers in the team, and this happens a lot. And one of the way to do that is through interaction terms. So adding an interaction terms, just use one times when it's the other one, and use zero and one. That's some of a way to deal with that in sociology. But as you can see here, it's kind of difficult because the overall relationship is kind of complex. And you can say like a lot of like collections will probably relate to say like, I don't know, like plantation, but that kind of happen at the same time with the collections. And yeah, so it kind of needs, I think it needs a separate model to understand. Because we actually thought about it and say we can consider so many different things in one model, but it will just, in terms of manuscript, that will be too much for audience to read.
Could you filter them by principal?
PCA?
Yeah.
We certainly discuss about that,
mm-hmm.
and to do PCA, but our ecologists not very happy with that because they were not, they want the very good explanation from the ecological variables, so
mm-hmm.
they are not very happy with that, and yeah, so we kind of back and forth and using PCA and back to original, and yeah, but certainly it's always a difficult situation to deal with like 400 variables and decide, even though we use expert knowledge to choose, but still kind of problematic for us to decide which one to go in.
This is the basic question.
Sure.
So do you have an understanding of how this stuff propagates without humans around? Your transects.
I think yes.
Those transects are all on the forest edge.
Right. So,
but some of them may be in areas where people walk, and some may be in areas where people don't walk.
Right.
Some are far from where anybody walks. But I'm just wanting to think about how to tease it apart. It would be really nice to know, in a pristine environment, where the stuff lands, how it spreads, I suppose the ecologist would tell you that,
right?
It seems the whole area is human impacted.
Yeah, because that's a community forest.
There's no natural environment.
But
there's no part of the forest that's not, that doesn't have people.
No, that's the community forest.
Even the protected areas.
No, the protected areas, people will not be able to go into.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. Information, ecological information.
But their transect didn't go into those areas.
But if we're trying to solve the problem, information or studies about how it propagates without people
mm-hmm.
would be a really important
mm-hmm.
baseline, give you a lot of leverage to tease apart the variables.
So this project be able to get funded from ASF is because we are adding the social components to it. So almost all the previous invasive species analysis research, they purely done by ecologists, and they basically doing the ecological survey, and not in Nepal, but in some other area, South America and something. But the kind of important thing here is that we really have a mixed area of human and the natural systems, and we'll be able to kind of assess the social parameters. And back to your question, I believe yes. So people certainly have done something like not that much human disturbance, and look at invasive species, how that spread is, and there's a theory, I believe, underneath. It's more related to ecology, like how the invasive species will go around.
Yeah, I'm just saying, all that literature should be a baseline
here, right?
Shouldn't it?
Yeah, and we come up with the hypothesis that say the biophysical still factor still the predominant, and that's from the previous literature, and that's majority people say biophysical factors will really influence that, and that's the predominant, and we're trying to see if the social factors really influence that at all or not, but the interesting thing as I said about illegal collection. So people join, when we do a survey, we don't really have a boundary of where's the park, where's the community forest. And they join, say, oh, last year I do a search here. and at an interview, we don't know that. But eventually when we touch the data, and And a social demographer, you know, Ting, the professor in Penn State, and he said, oh, that's illegal collection. And typically, if you do a regular survey, people will not tell you, right? And in his manuscript say, that's kind of a unique data set to get a real sense of how households doing illegal things. And I mean, we certainly protect them, we'll not say who actually have done that, but that's kind of an interesting thing. And he's doing this research by correlating with their demography factors, gender, I mean income, whatever, whatever. And also considering their distance, they live in a valley, but their distance to the community forest, some of them probably live far away, so that's why they go into somewhere else. And we also incorporate like invasive species coverage for the forest. Is that because the forest is densely covered by the invasive species? And that's why they go into the protected area. So yeah, so that paper is kind of presented in PAA and for 2 years ago. And that's under development. So several papers will be out, I think, this year, and specifically about this project. And yeah, and we're trying to move it forward, and a lot of things still unknown and like complex. So yeah, I think another round of the ecological survey will be kind of useful, and especially just see how it evolves across time. And after we do this project, we talk a lot with the community forest managers and also the households, and see if our research or say the real intervention will change their perception to the invasive species, and see if that will help the forest to be more sustainable in the future.
Have you considered any fuzzy model in terms of the factors, their impact, you know?
Say no. Yeah, but that's an option. Yeah, but I mean, we certainly have a lot of discussion about the modeling mechanism in negative binomial, that's one I've presented here, and I'm doing the GWR, and that's another one. And yeah, and people just, yeah, so many options, and we kind of, yeah, so it's a bit hard because we, and especially when we're in an interdisciplinary team, people have their guideline, like in ecology, they tend to do things in this way. And in sociology, they tend to do things in that way, and prove to be successful, and they get promoted to full professors, and prove to be successful, and they tend to stay with their guideline and trying to protect their areas. So when I present GWR to them, they kind of say, "Yeah, that's great," and what else? I mean, so things can happen like that, but that's about communication, and people will reach to a same idea, and also it depends on which journal you want to go. So if you really want to go to ecological journal and go to which audience you want then to read this research, so it kind of depends on a lot of factors to decide the methodologies.
Oh, I hope the methodology determined by what problem you want to solve rather than what journal you want to publish.
Yeah, so yeah, so if we really go to the comprehensive journals, it's probably easier because that's interdisciplinary already, kind of, accept all type of different things. So yeah, so we kind of think about it and still in the process. Yeah, so
can you talk about the tools you used for the project?
You mean the modeling or
the
software,
the programming languages.
So the negative binomial is done by the R package, the PSCL, and the GWR I was done it by the, I mean the, there's a GUI version as well as there's a command line version in Python, in Python actually.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so we mostly doing that in open source, and we don't really use like SAS or SPSS anymore because that's less development and not easy to share. And yeah, so and a lot of data handling, I use Python, I use Pandas, and that's a good a package. And for like remote sensing stuff, we still kind of rely on, we don't really do classification here. So the simple GIS just can be done easily by, you know, the QGIS or ARC, and that's fine. And the remote sensing stuff, the EVI also easily calculate. That's just a band calculation, so that's quite easy.
Yeah, so that's the package, and we...
Did you do any...
Oh, yeah, so back to this polygon stuff.
Right.
So that's kind of messy. When people join this, it will do... Sometimes they do a good job like that. That's great. But sometimes people doing half of that, or they go over again. So you need to kind of decide, what did they really mean? So
tool did you build this survey?
This one? That's on a tablet, like Windows tablet. Yeah.
Is that using Basemap or HTML5 or what is it?
So this one, I don't remember exactly the package because that's developed by the Penn State professors.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
He's handling that.
Okay.
And I don't think he plans to make it open source, but he's using it for multiple different other projects,
I could see that something like this would be useful for a lot of people.
Yeah,
of surveys could use it.
Are those vertical lines, are those the transects, those vertical lines, or what?
So the
that's a roads. That's just base map. That's map.
I see, so the roads are...
roads are kind of... Imperfect surface. That's just a satellite image.
No, they're vertical. They're vertical lines on the image, right?
Oh, this one?
Yeah, those are probably farming.
That's farming,
right?
Farming boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's an agricultural area, actually. Yeah. So this one is actually besides this NSF and Project PI, his name Scott Ibiku at Penn State, and he got another NIH R21 grant, just about innovative tablet survey.
Mm.
And we kind of have two projects going together.
Mm.
So we also just testing, we do a household survey, we gave them a paper map, kind of 4x4 feet, 4 feet by 4 feet, really large, asked them to do similar things, and we use a tablet. And the results after analysis, we find out that's good for the elderly people, especially for the tablet. We think of they will have a problem to using a tablet because of technology, but actually that's good for them because they don't need to kind of go around, look at a map, and they can just play along with the tablet and we have a higher accuracy for that. And yeah, so that's kind of interesting findings also.
So one thought on accuracy. I'm sorry, Jeff, I think you're trying to ask a question, right?
Eventually, yeah.
Okay, just one. Because it's so easy to draw that big red circle there, you know, somebody could draw a massively bigger area than they're actually gathering wood in. Like, that looks like a huge area to be gathering wood in.
Yeah.
So you have to wonder, when you make it really, really easy to draw on a map, you have to really think about what that might mean.
Yeah, so when we do the interview, we will give a bit more guidelines.
Okay.
Say, when you draw, say, we try to understand the community forest, and we will say just try to do as accurate as possible.
Yeah,
but
try to zoom in.
But if it's for a year, it's not that one trip of gathering wood in that big area, right?
No,
that's
our region. That's our region,
right?
The problem behind this is really the time consuming to close all the polylines to polygon. And if they are drawing like...
Yeah, you kind of have to just go over each one manually.
Yeah, for this data, we hire student workers to go through.
Or you can use the app to allow them to only rubber band polygons and not allow them to...
Right.
Them to create any polygons.
That makes it harder for old people to
draw. But how to close the polygon directly?
No, they start with a polygon, so it would be...
Oh, it's moving the...
Yeah, three
vertex.
Vertices would be
Yeah,
closed,
moving vertices.
Right?
Yeah, that's another way. I saw like in some commercial apps like Zillow,
uh-huh.
you want to look at a real estate and say, I want to buy a house. and I can draw like in phone app, you can draw like a polygon and like a line, and it will automatically close for you.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, they will just connect the shortest distance. But sometimes when people drawing like that, or they drawing half of that, that they probably mean different. So when I draw like a little bit larger and not really close, they probably wants to,
they regret the starting point.
Yeah, regret that point, and they want to kind of close like that.
Yeah.
But it is not. But if you just connect the lines,
that
would be strange.
It'll be odd, strange.
Yeah, it would be strange.
So you can build the algorithm to say that the last vertex close by the shortest distance to the existing line or something like that.
Right. So we, I kind of work with a project PI, and we're trying to see if there's a machine learning algorithm, because we already have the original data set. We have the validated data set, and we have the human chain, we have the student workers to finish that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to see if we can come up with like a new algorithms to help these kind of apps to automatically close the shape in a good way.
Yeah.
And that's kind of under proposal development.
Yeah, I think
development
it should be fairly straightforward too.
Right.
To do.
So yeah, so there are multiple ways to do that. And that's kind of the data quality stuff here.
One more question is autocorrelation.
Yeah.
Did you test for that? The spatial autocorrelation?
So for the negative binomial, no. But for the GWR, we certainly, but that's also a bit different, because that's all like ecological plots, and we can do that. And but it's kind of interesting, because when you're trying to define the neighbors, you probably can only use the distance, and the GWR kind of capture that, I believe.
GWR pretty much
handles autocorrelation.
But your modified regression.
I don't really run like a Moran psi for it. No.
Mm.
Yeah. But I mean, when I run GWR, I believe that kind of capture that spatial relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned GWR is commonly misapplied.
Yes. That's not I say. That's Stuart say.
Is this because the same band is used for all variables?
That's not only about that.
Is using multiscalar.
No. So the reason behind that is that a lot of people, they don't really understand very well how GWR works, and they just grab the software package and run. But the good way to do GWR is really, you need to have a very good global model, say whatever. So it can be ordinary square, the ORS, you can be Poisson regression, you can be logistic, and a negative binomial that's under development. But the thing is that you kind of need to have a good global model, rather than you have a 3% R square of the linear regression, and then you got a GWR and get a 90%. That makes no sense. So if you don't
You're saying it should always be compared to another model.
Right. So you'll get R square from GWR, and you will get R square from the linear regression. But if you got only like 3% of a linear regression, you should go back to look at your original regression and see what other factors really cause this variance in a model, rather than you're using a GWR and find out, okay, so increase from 3% to 50%, done, I publish a paper. And a lot of people from other domain, transportation, health, public health, they use GWR and help their, I mean, they can publish, but from Stuart's idea, that's a lot of misuse. And also when you use the GWR, you cannot use the regular 1.96 for 95%, I mean the significant level. You need to do a correction because of the estimation process. And right now in the new multi-scale GWR, it automatically do the adjusted t-value for all the users. You just use the new one rather than use the 1.96. Yeah, so there's multiple kind of a statistical requirement to use GWR in a good way. And yeah, Stuart kind of regularly teach the class in ASU, and yeah, that helps a lot. He kind of wrote a guideline to how to apply the GWR analysis, and it kind of helped. We took the class to help us understand how it works. But yeah, and I think right now with the more and more the statistical development happened in the GWR and the MGWR, or say the semi-parametric GWR, and we get more and more tools to actually move it forward. So yeah, so I think he's kind of preparing for one of the case study. He shouldn't do that, but he shouldn't does that, but he actually preparing for one for the US election, and that's ongoing process. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, I think it would be important to have some good papers, applied papers, people to look at.
Jeff, I think your question is really a good one, but you could probably use that analogy. Like if you have a scattered point, right? And you want to fit a curve through it. If you fit a global equation through it, there's no good match. Right, but if you allow that curve to go in really high-powered polynomial, you could fit a perfect curve through all the existing points, but that curve really doesn't mean anything at the end. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that's
it's a similar thing.
That's kind of overfitting, underfitting.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
You would just abuse your data and abuse the flexibility of the model to stretch and stretch for a best fit, but the result becomes meaningless.
That's what the data
is. Yeah.
Yeah, you're describing the spatial pattern of the data.
Yeah. But then it doesn't represent anything else.
Strong relationship.
Right.
Yeah. But that's a very common problem for
a
lot of statistical
happens a lot.
Work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Overfitting.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot more like in machine learning when you're doing like a random forest, like a boosting tree, and they already develop a lot of algorithms kind of to prune your tree, because sometimes the classification system will keep going, you'll get higher and higher accuracy, but sometimes that will not really make sense. So that's, and you can think of GWR is another way of the machine learning, but that's just considering a spatial relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You have a kernel, basically.
Yeah. It needs to be babysat. So that's good.
Can
these humans are still useful.
Can I use a very ask a very general question?
Sure.
I know that this project is a teamwork. There are so many different domain experts involved, right? Now, if you were tasked to go back and do this again, every decision is your own, how would you do it differently? Or would you do it any differently?
I will bring more of the, the remote sensing ideas. Because right now we do the ecological plots in a very, you mentioned this morning, a lecture. But I think we certainly need to bring in some hyperspectrum remote sensing technologies. And it can scan around a forest in a really good way. And ground truth is always important, but have something from remote sensing, that will be also very important to get this going. So originally in this team, we have a geographer, Lee in San Diego State, but he's more of the human environment geographers, and he's not that, physical side, and he's doing the ABM part of it, so he's also not on the remote sensing side. If I do it again, so I would say trying to see the opportunities of the hyperspectrum remote sensing technologies. I think that would be really useful. And this student, PhD student from San Diego State, he he got a fellowship from NASA actually, and bring one of the handheld hyperspectrum instruments to Nepal, but let's handheld from the bottom up. Because right now you get more UAVs, right? You can try to get a hyperspectral camera there, just fly away.
But the handheld one will give you the calibration data.
Yeah, the handheld one is already very useful. Yeah. You get really the spectrum information.
Yeah.
And he's working on that for his dissertation, really trying to see, go back to the spectrum library, what's the soil, what's the tree, what's the invasive species, and look at it. And but if you have got a UAV and you flew over the forest, you'll get some ideas. So yeah, so I believe a lot of things can be done for this particular project. But sometimes the project just depends on who's in the team and what people's ideas about it.
Right.
So
okay.
That's the thing.
I have one thought or one question for you.
Sure.
So you said that, you know, it's really interesting to think about how the problem of finding invasives could be similar or correlate to the problem of spotting cancers or
right.
various growths in the human body. If you were to take that analogy further, the people here, the people who are out gathering firewood, are they part of the cancer, or are they part of the are they the doctors, or are they something else?
Yeah, the cause of cancer.
Are there so it's actually the combination of the invasive and the humans that is actually the invader, or the tumor equivalent.
So that's kind of internal and external factors. So you think of the cancer happen, it has the internal problems from cancer biology. They would say that's a gene problem, that's internal. But there's external problems because of the immune system not working, because of some other chemical factors, some other things influence the human body. And you can see here, like, internal stuff is that invasive species kind of brought, I mean, it's kind of different. Brought in, if you think of X-ray to hit a person, the person get a cancer, and that's probably okay in this case. But that's human beings here will be kind of the external factors to the, I mean, for the cancer, and just making it kind of spread out, and some of the factors really influence that. And yeah, so this and this is kind of interesting, because when I go to the literature and just say invasive species cancer cells, and it comes out with like papers from biology and people publish and talking about how can we learn from invasive species ecology and to treat the cancers. So we have a lot of and also back and forth, people say we spend a lot of money, a lot of time to help people survive when they have a cancer, kind of prevent a cancer. And how can we use those strategies back to the invasive species and stop this happen again and again in the world? So yeah, so I like your example. That's pretty, it kind of inspire my thoughts and see what is kind of relate these two in a much deeper way and see how that goes. Yeah.
Human is the cancer causing poison plus the curing drug.
Curing drug,
exactly. And so the changes in the behavior, if outcome from a study like this could drive changes in the gathering behavior.
Right, right.
And the cleaning as they're in their gathering,
mm-hmm.
you know, that could be the human, which is the equivalent of the disease, could turn around and become the human, which is the equivalent of the cure.
Yeah.
Is that?
We'll see the human power, right?
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's a lot of education, and also, I mean, just to help the local residents really think about it, how to do things differently. So, and also interesting things that Rocomolina, the other type of the invasive species, and people starting to say we use Comolina as a firewood. So the invasive species is become kind of a way for people to use, and just making I mean people's
an
perception will kind of change.
Yeah.
Like,
if you can find an economic use for the invasive species.
Yeah, if that's useful, then useful.
Well, at least